My name's Rick Dunning, and I am a geographer and geologist by training. I teach both of those subjects on the college level back in Minnesota, and here at Holden, I work up in the Portal Museum. This afternoon, as part of our ongoing Earth Study series, I'll be presenting the session entitled The Coevolution of Climate and Life. The Earth Study has been an important part of our program this summer, intended to help us understand the creation and help us to understand some of the problems, some of the environmental problems that are facing us at the present time. I think that part of the Earth Study is also to give us a basic understanding of the way that the environment, that the creation works. And that's part of what I want to talk about today. The title perhaps sounds a little more ambitious than it really is. I'm really not going to talk too much about evolution, and certainly don't intend too much to get into the traditional controversies over evolution. But what I'd like to talk about is the relationship between living organisms on the planet and the Earth's climatic systems. The relationship between the organisms and the climate, and what some of the implications of those relationships might be for understanding our environmental problems. In a sense, what I'm trying to do is set up a little bit of a context for understanding problems like the greenhouse effect and the depletion of the ozone layer. The title is not original to me, it's the title of a book, and I'm sorry, but I can't give you the authors of that book right now. But I have borrowed that title for this session. So The Coevolution of Climate and Life. Now, let's start with the composition of the atmosphere. Does anyone know what the atmosphere is made of?
Oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide.
Oxygen, nitrogen, carbon dioxide. Ozone, okay. Any other things you can think of might be in the atmosphere?
Water and dust.
Water, sure. H2O, particularly in the vapor form. Bit of dust. Pollution? Sure. What things you can think of besides birds? any ideas on the relative importance of those gases? How much of each? What's the most abundant gas in the atmosphere?
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen makes up about 78% of the atmosphere, in fact. So nitrogen in our atmosphere is essentially inert. It does nothing to us physically. It really has no effect in the atmosphere meteorologically. Nitrogen is extracted from the atmosphere by plants and incorporated into various nitrogen compounds in the soil as fertilizers. So it does enter into the plant nutrient cycle, but in the atmosphere it does virtually nothing except kind of add space or fill up space. Next would be oxygen, about 20.9% roughly. And one we left off the list, argon, makes up about 0.9%. Again, relatively inert. All of these don't have much effect in terms of the climatic system. Oxygen is, of course, very dear to us in terms of our breathing. And there are various trace gases, helium, krypton, hydrogen in very, very tiny amounts. And these are the permanent gases. And then there are some variable gases that occur in different amounts at different times. And carbon dioxide is one of those variable gases. Water vapor, one of those variable gases. Ozone is one of those variable gases, O3. Now, water can be anywhere from 0 to 4% of the atmosphere at any one time. So we may have a lot of oxygen or a lot of water vapor in the air at one time. We may have very little water vapor in the air at a given time. Carbon dioxide makes up about 0.035%, and the numbers here are terribly important. Another way to express that is it makes up about 3 parts per million in the atmosphere. 353 parts per million. So for every million molecules, 353 of them would be carbon dioxide. That's not very much. There's really not, in terms of the total volume of the atmosphere, there's not much CO2 in there. Ozone is maybe 2 parts per billion. So even less ozone in the atmosphere. Although the ozone tends to be concentrated in a layer in the lower part of the stratosphere that we refer to as the ozone layer. But that's basically what we've got in our atmosphere. What if we compare the Earth's atmosphere with our planetary neighbors like Venus and Mars? The atmospheres of those two planets are pretty similar. Carbon dioxide is by far and away the major constituent of both of those atmospheres, in excess of 95% of the atmosphere of both Venus and Mars is carbon dioxide. There's a little bit of nitrogen, maybe 1 to 3% nitrogen, and just a trace of water vapor. And a trace of maybe oxygen. No oxygen. All right. So the Earth's atmosphere is very different from the atmosphere of the other planets, at least close to us. Now, next question we might ask is, where does the Earth's atmosphere come from? What is the source of this gas that makes up the atmosphere? Primarily volcanoes. Gases coming out of a volcano. We don't think about that much. We think about, I don't know if you were here for the slideshow on Wednesday night, we think about lava coming out of volcanoes, and we think about ash coming out of volcanoes. But a large volume of the material erupting out of a volcano is in the form of gas. And through the millions and billions of years of Earth history, those volcanoes have contributed the gases to our atmosphere. Once the gases erupt, then the gravitational field of the Earth is enough to pull those gases in close to the Earth's surface. So the molecules of gas are held there by the Earth's gravitational field. The gases are compressed by the pull of gravity so that the atmosphere is thicker close to the surface and thinner as you get into higher altitudes. Now, if we measure the kind of gas that comes out of the volcano, water vapor is about roughly 70% of that. So most of the gas coming out is steam and water vapor. And about 20% is carbon dioxide, roughly. And nitrogen compounds of various kinds, about 5%. And sulfur compounds of various kinds, about 5%. Now, if you look at our present atmosphere, and you look at the gas that comes out of volcanoes, the gas that we started with as our atmosphere, they're not the same. Something's really different about the composition of volcanic gas and the composition of our present atmosphere. What's the biggest change? Well, I need to get rid of this water vapor. Where'd the water vapor go?
Ideas? It condensed.
Condensed became the oceans of the world. So most of the water vapor has fallen as precipitation and run off into the oceans. But here's our big question. Where does the oxygen come from in the Earth's atmosphere?
Photosynthesis.
And what is photosynthesis?
Plants change carbon dioxide into oxygen.
Okay, so it's in the plant respiration process. Plants take sunlight and carbon dioxide and through chemical reactions create food and give off oxygen as a waste product. So here is this planet Earth, which has oxygen when the others around it do not. The reason planet Earth has oxygen is because planet Earth has living organisms. Now, living organisms, at least most of the ones that make up our present ecosystems, need oxygen to live in the environment. And yet, the reason the environment has oxygen is because there are living organisms. Suddenly you're in a kind of a which came first scenario, the chicken or the egg. Which came first, the living organisms or the oxygen? And in fact, if we look at very old rocks on the Earth's surface, it's apparent that living organisms and oxygen in the atmosphere have grown up together, if you will, have evolved together. So that as the complexity of living organisms has changed on the Earth's surface through geologic time, so has the composition of the atmosphere. And in a sense then, the environment, the climatic environment of the world, is a product of the organisms that live there. So that there's a very intimate relationship between the organisms and the atmosphere and the climate around us. Question so far? Is that making reasonable sense? Now, let's talk a little bit about the sequence of events. I don't think I need to do much more writing on the chalkboard. Start acting too much like a teacher here. Sorry.
This may be a dumb question at this point, but where does the water come from when it comes out of a volcano? Where is that generated?
It is contained within the molten lava under very high pressure. And as the lava escapes toward the surface and cools off, then the water vapor is released. So it's really contained within the rock material, within the molten rock material. Now, sit down. The Earth's earliest atmosphere probably looked a lot like the atmosphere of Venus. I don't know if you've seen pictures of Venus, but Venus is the planet closer to the Sun from Earth. And Venus is covered by clouds, very thick clouds. In fact, we don't really know what the planet surface looks like because we've never been able to photograph through that cloud cover. Basically, the atmosphere was very rich in carbon dioxide and full of clouds. There was no oxygen in the original atmosphere. And as the water condensed out of the clouds to form the oceans, the oceans had very high acidity, because a lot of the sulfur that comes out of the volcano mixes in with the water to create acid rain, natural acid rain instead of human-induced acid rain. Now, that's a very inhospitable planet, very hot. The ocean was hot, the atmosphere was hot, it was cloudy all the time, and the water was very acidic. And any living thing that we have today probably could not have survived there. Very few living things could have survived under those conditions. But under those conditions, within the oceans, we began a series of very complex chemical reactions taking place in these hot oceans that led eventually to the formation of living cells. Now, these reactions could not have taken place in the present environment. They couldn't have taken place in the presence of oxygen. Many of these organic molecules that first formed in the ocean have been duplicated in laboratory experiments. And you can't make them if there's oxygen present, because the oxygen is deadly to the organic molecules. Now, I'm going to present a scenario here. This is essentially a culling together of several best guessed scenarios of how life might have originated in terms of a scientific explanation for it. Now, by life, we mean it's something that's made of organic molecules. Basically, it's carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen combined together in various forms to make the organic molecules. The organism has cells that replicate, can duplicate, can reproduce. The organism must carry on some kind of metabolic reaction, like photosynthesis or respiration or fermentation. The organism has to be able to move. It has to be able to exchange gases and liquids with the outside environment, and it has to be able to adapt to changes in the environmental conditions. That's kind of a rough working definition of what makes a living organism. So there are organic molecules in the world that aren't living. In order to be called a living organism, it has to meet all of those criteria. And even under today's conditions, there are people that debate, is this a living organism? Is this some viruses, for example? People are not quite sure whether a virus really qualifies as a living organism or not. And we don't need to get too much into that. But those are some of the characteristics of living organisms. And according to this scenario, we begin in these hot, acidic oceans with a series of chemical reactions, molecules combining together in various combinations, so that increasingly we get more and more complex organic molecules, and the molecules start getting bigger and bigger. Finally, we start to get combinations of organic molecules that fit this definition of life through the random chemical reactions over thousands of millions of years. Eventually, we get a combination of organic molecules that can do all of the things I just listed, respond to environmental changes, replicate itself, etc. And essentially, the simple cells, the simple one-celled organisms that we first started with, began from random chemical reactions in this hot ocean, at least according to this scenario. Now, there's a problem with this scenario, and that is that we don't really know how it happened. Because it all happened before we have any evidence. All of these changes are what we call pre-geologic. By that I mean there's no physical evidence left of that time period in Earth history. The Earth is about 4.6 to 4.8 billion years old But the oldest rocks on Earth, the oldest physical evidence that we have of anything on Earth is only 3.8 billion years old. So the first billion years of Earth history, there's nothing left from it except a few chemical compounds, a few atoms, essentially, in younger rock. So a lot of these hypothetical scenarios took place before we've got any solid evidence. We know that these organisms would have lived in conditions without oxygen, called anaerobic conditions. That probably they lived by a metabolic process called photosynthesis. Fermentation, in which they use nutrients from the environment and got their energy through the process of fermentation, not from sunlight. Now, through geologic history, all the cloudiness in the Earth was starting, and the atmosphere was starting to decrease because more and more of the water was condensing out of the atmosphere as the Earth got cooler. So as things got cooler, it was raining more, fewer clouds in the atmosphere means that more sunlight starts to come through to the Earth's surface. And this sunlight provides a new energy source, for living organisms. There's still no oxygen. There's still no ozone because you can't get ozone unless there's oxygen. And so all these simple one-celled organisms are living in the ocean because at least the ocean offers a little bit of protection from ultraviolet radiation coming from the sun. And as the clouds were decreasing, more ultraviolet radiation was increasing. We then, about 3.5 billion years ago, have the oldest evidence of living organisms. And these organisms were more advanced than the earliest organisms would have been. These organisms lived by photosynthesis. In other words, they got their energy from sunlight, not from the Earth's environment. But they were still anaerobic. They still lived without oxygen. And instead of giving off oxygen as a result of photosynthesis, they gave off sulfur. And if you've ever walked through a swamp, kind of smelled the gas that bubbles up from the bottom of a swampy area, it's a kind of a sulfur smell to it. Because the bacteria that live underwater, under conditions without oxygen, still have anaerobic photosynthesis. They still give off sulfur as a result of that process. Now, we started finally to get about 3.5 billion years ago oxygen in the atmosphere, but this oxygen was coming from a process called photochemical dissociation. Big word. Basically, it means that the ultraviolet energy from the sun was splitting apart water molecules. And those water molecules, they've got hydrogen in them and they've got oxygen in them. And as they were split apart, it started to provide some oxygen for the atmosphere. Not very much, but enough that under the conditions of oxygen, we started to get a new kind of organism, one that we call an aerobic photosynthesizer. It used sunlight, but it lived in oxygen conditions rather than no oxygen conditions. Now, oxygen is essentially poisonous to organisms that are anaerobic. The earlier organisms could not survive with oxygen in the atmosphere. And today they only survive in places where there is no oxygen, underwater, deep underwater usually. We started to find, how do we know, let's think about the evidence here, how do we know there was no oxygen originally? One way is by the kinds of rocks that we find on the Earth's surface, the kind of minerals that are inside the rocks. There are certain minerals that only form under conditions without oxygen.
And the presence of those minerals in very old rocks suggests that there was no oxygen in the atmosphere. And about 3.5 billion years ago, we start to get little layers of red sediments. Now the red comes from iron, rusting iron, just like on your car bumper. But here, the rusting iron is a process called oxidation. And the iron changes to this red color only in the presence of oxygen. So when you start getting red bands in the rock layers, that's an indication that the oxygen in the atmosphere is gradually increasing. Now about 2 billion years ago, we start to get thicker and thicker layers of these red rocks. Red beds, they're called, red sediment layers. And again, the red is from oxidized iron within the rock. And those would have been forming about the time the oxygen content in the atmosphere reached 1%. So we finally got the level of oxygen in the atmosphere up to about 1% by 2 billion years ago. We've gone through half of the history of the world. The only living organisms still are very simple one-celled organisms that don't even have a nucleus. And we're finally just starting to get some oxygen in the atmosphere. Just 1% of the atmosphere is oxygen by this point. But the changes happen much more quickly after this. The photosynthetic organisms that take advantage of the sunlight and give off oxygen were able to reproduce much more efficiently and much more effectively in the environment. And so they were able to dominate the environment. And essentially the photosynthetic organisms, even the simple one-celled photosynthetic organisms, took over in this environment. And all of the anaerobic organisms that could not survive in the presence of oxygen were forced into very sheltered environments, only a very few sheltered environments. Now, in the presence of increasing oxygen, the next major evolutionary step in terms of living organisms was the development of cells that had a nucleus. And the nucleus in the cell contains the genetic material, the DNA, the chromosomes. And the nucleated cells require oxygen in order to carry out their respiration process. So they could only form in the presence of oxygen. By about 700 million years ago then, the oxygen content was up to about 10%. And we start to get, in the presence of that increasing oxygen content, we start to get the first multicellular organisms, the first complex organisms, the first animals, the first multicellular plants. All of this still in the ocean. All of these early life forms are in the ocean because there's still no ozone layer. And remember what ozone does in the atmosphere. Ozone is a gas in the lower part of the stratosphere that blocks out the sun's ultraviolet radiation. That's the ultraviolet radiation that will damage living organisms. And the fact that we can run around on the Earth's surface is because that ozone layer protects us from the ultraviolet radiation. Well, until there was an ozone layer, everything had to live in the ocean because the water provided some shelter from the ozone, from the harmful effects of the ultraviolet radiation. So even 700 million years ago, all the life was living in the ocean. The first land plants came about by about 300 million years ago. And the first land animals, the first amphibians to go up onto the land surface about 250 million years ago. Now, I do this just about every talk I give, I think. But when you talk about geologic time, it's always hard to try and imagine what we mean by a billion years or a million years. So think about it this way. If we take all these 4.6 billion years of Earth history and we compress them down into 1 year, 1 year of time, then the land plants and land animals have only made their appearance during the last month. So out of the whole 12 months of geologic history, almost over 80%, over 90% of the Earth's history, it's just in this last little bit that we finally get organisms emerging onto the land. And with land plants, then the oxygen content increases even more rapidly in the atmosphere. And so that we go from 10% to the present day 20%. Now, that's, like I say, a sketchy scenario of the early history of life. Now we can bat that around a little bit as to the details, and like I say, this is just a composite of several hypothetical scenarios at this point. We know that there are one-celled simple organisms in rocks that are 3.5 billion years old. So we have a history of life that goes back to the earliest rocks on the Earth's surface. And in order for those particular organisms, those photosynthesizing organisms that are 3.5 billion years ago, there had to be some older ancestor. We can assume or kind of suggest at least that there had to be something that came before the photosynthetic organisms. And so those would have been the pre-geologic organisms. Now, let's think a minute about this composition of the atmosphere again and think about it, what it means for the Earth's climatic system. Most of the Earth's atmosphere is nitrogen, oxygen, and argon. Though oxygen, as I say, is important to us for our respiration purposes, but essentially, those three gases perform no function climatically. They have no effect on the working of the Earth's climate system. The gases which are most important climatically are the variable gases, water vapor, carbon dioxide, and ozone. Those are by far and away the most important gases in the atmosphere. And yet they're present in such small amounts. There's just a little bit of carbon dioxide, there's just a little bit of ozone, a very tiny amount of ozone, and variable amounts of water vapor. Sometimes a lot, sometimes a little, depending on which part of the world you happen to live in. Now, water vapor and carbon dioxide are important because they help us they help the atmosphere to warm up. They hold heat. They are what we call greenhouse gases. And greenhouse effect is an important thing. We need to be clear about that. The way the atmosphere works, or the way the whole weather system works, is that the sunlight heats up the Earth. And then the Earth gives off heat, which warms up the atmosphere. The sun heats the Earth, and then the Earth is what heats the atmosphere. And it's water vapor and carbon dioxide that absorb heat in the atmosphere. If they weren't there, we'd freeze. So the fact that we've got water vapor and carbon dioxide means that we've got heat held into the atmosphere. The ozone layer, we've already suggested, protects us from ultraviolet radiation from the sun. So it too performs an important climatic function. Now, because these gases, particularly carbon dioxide and ozone, because they're present in such tiny amounts in the atmosphere, those are the gases that are most vulnerable to human activity. And that's where the pollution problems become so important. The fact that there's just a little bit of each of those gases there means that it doesn't take much messing around by people to change the content, the relative amount of those gases. And that's where two of our biggest pollution problems are coming from right now. What we usually refer to as the greenhouse effect refers to the fact that the human activity of burning fossil fuels is releasing more carbon dioxide into the air. And as the carbon dioxide increases, then it's going to absorb more heat, the atmosphere will get warmer. So that by polluting the air with carbon dioxide and also some other kinds of pollutants like methane gas and other synthetic pollutants, we are actually in danger of possibly warming up the atmosphere. And then the other major effect that seems to be going on at the moment is that some of the chemical pollutants we're releasing are actually having the effect of decreasing the ozone layer. That the chemicals rise to the upper part of the atmosphere and actually destroy the ozone, so that during human history, the ozone layer has been depleted by about 5% so far, particularly in the polar regions, where the ice clouds have a more pronounced effect on these chemical reactions. Yeah.
I'd like to ask a question on that. If I've heard that from so many different sources, including the talk that I went to earlier this week, but if things were to return to normal as far as the amount of CO2 emissions on the planet right now, how long would it take for the ozone layer to return to normal?
Well, the ozone formation process is a pretty slow one. In most cases, the ozone is created by lightning in the upper atmosphere. That's one of the major sources of ozone, splitting apart oxygen molecules, and then the free oxygen atom joins with another oxygen molecule to make the ozone molecule. So the formation is a slow process. The other thing that complicates this is that the gases, the pollutants in the atmosphere, take a long time to go from the surface where they're released up to where the ozone layer is, many miles above the Earth's surface. And once they're there, they stay there for a long time before those chemicals finally break down. And so that even if today we stop emitting those chemical pollutants, the chemicals that have already been released will still affect the ozone layer for the next several decades. And so the implications of that are a little bit frightening. It means that the ozone layer will continue to diminish slightly, and the major threats would be with an increase of ultraviolet radiation coming through. Less ozone, so less to block out the radiation. If that's the case, one of the major effects would be an increase in skin cancer from the rays of the sun coming through.
Would you clarify for me the fact that in smog areas, we measure the smog by the elevation of the ozone?
That's exactly right.
How come that doesn't go up there?
It, at the ground surface, the pollution, the ozone produced by automobiles is a pollutant, and it will irritate your eyes and it will irritate your lungs, but it tends to stay at the ground level, perhaps because of the effects of
grit. I don't think I would blow it up there.
No, can't be. We use up more energy running the pumps to get the ozone up there and create more pollution that way than we'd saw.
So it really doesn't rise.
No, it stays right at the Earth's surface. And there it is a problem, which is a real quandary. Mm-hmm. But actually the amount of ozone that we produce totally is insignificant compared to the total amount we need. You know, it's just that it gets concentrated in some urban areas. And in where it's concentrated, it's a problem. But in the terms of the total atmosphere, it's too small an amount to worry about. Other question. This is really about as far as I intended to get with this. I'd like us, you know, to kind of have a chance to talk about
it. I came in so late, and I hope I'm not asking a question on something that you already covered, but on the atmosphere, when you're going through historically, the increase in the amount of oxygen in the mm-hmm. atmosphere, is that reached a point of stasis, or is that an increasing point or decreasing level now?
It seems to be fairly constant right now.
How conclusive is the evidence that the atmosphere is actually warming? I've heard a lot of conflicting.
Well, climatic changes are measured on very long-term averages, 30 years oftentimes. And so climatologists by nature are always reluctant to label this an increase in temperature. But it's clear that the 1980s were some of the warmest years this century in terms of global average temperatures. And one thing we do know is that carbon dioxide has been increasing. That's been clear. That's been measured fairly accurately. The temperature increase, as I say, the 80s were the warmest years of the century, just about. The connection is something that scientists tend to be a little bit conservative about making. But yes, it seems to be.
Can you explain to a person that doesn't understand what acid rain is, what causes it?
Okay. The question's about acid rain. Particularly when we burn coal, the burning of coal releases sulfur dioxide compounds into the atmosphere. And essentially those, and also nitrogen oxide compounds, but it's mainly the sulfur that causes the problem. The sulfur dioxide compounds combine with moisture in the atmosphere and make acid rain, make a mild sulfuric acid. And then that falls down as precipitation, both as rain or snow, and gets into lakes and rivers and harms.
It's like you're cycling over because of the way the water goes and pounded up and it's continuous cycle?
Generally speaking, when the water evaporates, whatever it is carrying in terms of other chemicals is left behind. So it won't increase because of the cycling of the hydraulic cycle, of the hydrologic. But it will increase in the areas where you've got lots of coal burning taking place. And some areas are more vulnerable to acid rain than others.
What about this area?
This area would be very vulnerable. And the areas that are vulnerable are those that have a lot of volcanic rocks and very thin soils. The areas that are less vulnerable are those that have thick sedimentary rocks, particularly limestone and thick soil covers. Because the limestone is a carbonate rock, calcium carbonate, and it tends to neutralize the acid. So it acts as a kind of a natural buffer for acid rain. But in areas like New England, and in northern Minnesota and Ontario, and in this region, you don't have those kinds of rocks and you don't have very thick soils. Now here in the Pacific Northwest, you don't have many coal burning plants downwind in the Seattle area. So it hasn't been as affected by acid rain as southern Canada and New England have been, because there's a pollution source, not just a vulnerable area. So it's, you know, another way that people are changing the composition of the atmosphere slightly and creating problems for themselves.
What are some of the alternatives to continuing to build up CO2, switching fuels?
switching fuels.
Say gasoline to methanol or switching from coal-burning power plants to some sort of direct conversion of sunlight to electricity. Yeah.
And probably the biggest step would be just conservation, just cutting back on how much energy we use, making cars and factories and appliances more efficient so that we cut down on the increase.
How big an effort, in the opinion of scientists, do they figure it would take for to stabilize or even to start a reversal of this continuing depletion of ozone? Is it in the case of looking at a generation beyond, or
well,
it's a tremendous effort, I'm sure.
The plan now, or the ideal now, would be to cut the use of these chemicals like chlorofluorocarbons, to cut the use of those by the year 2000 to virtually nothing, to try and eliminate them. And these are compounds that are used in air conditioning systems primarily, auto air conditioning and refrigerators and things like that. And the car air conditioning systems are the worst source of the pollutants. You get in an accident and break up the air conditioning system and it releases the refrigerants out into the atmosphere. Sometimes in the making of styrofoam and spray cans, at least in the past, the propellants that are used in the spray cans are made of these kinds of compounds because they're great chemically, because they don't mix with whatever you've got in your spray can. They don't mix with the deodorant or the spray paint. So they're great for their function, but when they get up in the upper atmosphere and they start to react with the sunlight, they start changing into things that will damage the ozone. So the goal is to just completely cut out the use of those kinds of compounds.
Would that alone make
enough
effort?
And then what we'd have to do is wait and hope that the next several decades don't get too much worse in terms of further damage. Because, like I say, we still have the effects of pollution that's already in the atmosphere waiting for us over the next several decades. So I imagine we'll be buying more suntan lotion and sunblock and sunglasses to try and wearing hats and things like that to try and
deal with. We're paying for what wasn't happening in the 40s and 50s.
Yes.
The coal burning and all the factories that were sending out all the good stuff.
Do chlorofluorocarbons exist at all in nature? Are they strictly a man-made substance?
I don't know. My impression is that they are synthetic. Strictly.
I'm just agreeing with
you. See, I've kind of seen a couple waves of the environmental movement. And in the late 60s, early 70s, a lot of the effort within the environmental movement was to stop pollution, to clean up the environment, to make it a livable environment, a better place to get the poisons out of the atmosphere and out of the lakes. And what we didn't think about at that point, and what we're just starting to realize, is not only is pollution an immediate problem in terms of the air we breathe and the water we drink, but the pollution now may start to affect the entire global climatic system. And that's the scary part of the pollution business. And that's why it's important to cut back on carbon dioxide pollution, to cut back on the chlorofluorocarbons, to just stop the use of them as soon as possible.
Is there any truth and validity to jet travel changing weather patterns?
It can, in some areas, increase cloudiness in the upper atmosphere, certainly. But in terms of
the jet fuels and all that, too, for like the atmosphere.
there was some concern initially with the supersonic transports that flew so high in the atmosphere that the jet fuels would have negative effects on the ozone layer. I think that as it turned out that those are such a small, minuscule part of the jet fleet that ultimately they didn't have the problems that we were concerned with.
Because they're working in a Super Concorde 2 right now. From London to Tokyo in 6 hours. And it's going to save me $10,000.
What's the price of progress?
That's my point.
Yeah.
What's the problem? You know, one keeps hearing and reading about scientists themselves argue back and forth whether or not danger zone or not, but no one seems to be really doing much about it, if there's even a possibility of becoming very dangerous.
Well,
why don't they start doing something to reverse it? I think the public is ready to pay for it. It ultimately is paid by the public to do all this. Why argue about it till it's too late? Why not try to reverse it, even though you know you may not have gotten there yet? Start cutting back and reversing it. I know it's a matter of economics in a lot of cases.
No, I think
I get tired of hearing about the arguments.
That's right.
Do something. You know, start doing it.
Who's the main they that we're talking about here? In terms of the who are the powers that pollute most, and we need to start looking at major corporations, major industries, and it's, I don't want to be real simplistic and put all the blame on them, because in a sense they're responding to consumer demand. But in terms of getting changes initiated, those corporate powers have tremendous economic and political power to slow down the process of change. And if you think about the world's largest corporations, the big oil companies, the big automobile manufacturers, they have annual sales that exceed the gross national product of most countries of the world. And these companies have become major powers, major global powers, politically and economically.
But the scientific world is arguing with each other, and someone has to listen to them. If they can get together and say, okay, we may not be there yet, but let's start. Yeah. If they could agree upon that, industry would have to listen to them.
That's true.
They use them for consultants.
We need a clearer voice among the scientific community, and we need to exercise the power that we do have as consumers to the best of our ability.
I think the point that the gentleman was raising is extremely important, and I think it can be validified by, if you look at simply this spotted owl problem that exists as far as the old growth national forests are concerned, where the vile political atmosphere that has been created in the last couple of 3 years is an argument that's based on roughly 10% of the total forests that existed in this area. And to try and save that 10%, there has been a very strong political situation, and it caused a lot of economic hardships, and it's really extremely difficult to get anything done. Because what one side of that is saying is that X number of years down the road, we will probably discover things from that old growth forest that exists that would make a tremendous difference on our standard of living or what have you. And if it's gone, it's gone forever. But the other side of that coin is saying no one knows what those things are. And right now it's affecting jobs.
Yeah.
And I think the same thing holds true with the ozone, with the cars that get 12 miles to the gallon, like my van, and all the rest of that.
I was wondering how much of the scientific community relating to problems like this are really underfunded. And and I'm thinking of the last president that we elected, who promised not to raise taxes, and the attitude of the average person on the street about paying for government in general, you know. It seems to me that the big corporations have a great ally there, really. That we're just not willing to spend the money to find out.
There's less genuine independent research.
Is there a feeling in the scientific community that really they are underfunded?
You know, and that the money that is available tends to go to big science, you know, the very expensive projects, dramatic things.
Yeah, I think the economics really drive it. You look at where the real polluters are, and you look at a steel mill in the United States or Japan or Germany, it's relatively innocuous compared to a steel mill in Eastern Europe, Russia, or some third world country which has absolutely no money to put into scrubbers, or, you know, they've got to keep their living up somehow, and they aren't going to put a nickel into this stuff. And how we help the third world is really, really tough.
We help them in other ways.
In the case of the automobile air conditioner, they are moving, experimenting, developing propellants that will be not harming, but they have to figure out that what they're going to replace it with is worse than what they've got, and damage the machinery that's out there. And so it's not a flip the switch overnight.
No, and they are working with techniques to recycle those compounds.
Maybe the question is whether we really need air conditioners in our cars.
Yes, that's true.
Well, the bottom line, I think, comes down to how many people know that their car air conditioner is going to emit fluorocarbons into the atmosphere. I think it's a lack of the knowledge on our part that we don't turn around and put pressure on government, science, whatever, to do something about it. There's a very, I mean, our society is very ignorant. I mean, they think, ooh, greenhouse effect, well, what's that? Well, they're saying it's going to get hot. They don't know why it's caused or what its ramifications are. It's just basically a lack of knowledge on our part. Well, these people are, what they're saying is certainly true, but I'll speak for myself. 10 years ago, for all of first 30 years of our marriage, we didn't have any air conditioners in our cars. Now we have them, and I knew all this stuff, but I haven't asked to turn off the air conditioner yet. You know, it's a lot of it is not what we know. It's just like a lot of moral issues in society. It's not what we know, but what we're willing to sacrifice.
What was real heartening to me, this year when we celebrated Earth Day, which is the 20-year anniversary, I was reading the literature, the facts, as we've been talking about how facts are just all over, which ones are true. In reading the facts, it said that 103 countries were celebrating Earth Day. And that was what I was looking for, that it's a world problem. And certainly we consume something like two-thirds of the energy, three-quarters of the energy in this country consumes in the entire world. I see a change that's happened. I see we begin to start looking at evolution of the climate. Well, you know, where is our climate going to evolve? And what's going to happen because of human behavior? And I guess I have some questions like, you know, how is the United Nations involved with this? I don't know what the rules are or how the United Nations evolved, but certainly if 103 countries are celebrating Earth Day, it tells me that some things are happening worldwide. And Earth Day, I think, started in this country. And how to decide which facts to use to make our decisions, and which group or groups are going to decide that. And it's really, it's not just a country issue, it's a worldwide issue. I mean, if we conserve fluorocarbons here, what about the rest of the world? You know, it's much broader, and I think we're discovering that. So 20 years ago, I remember that. I wasn't thinking of the broadness of it. I wasn't thinking about what we could do to an ozone layer for the whole Earth, and it seems like we're discovering now, well, what we did 20 years ago or whatever, is it has long-term effects. Effects that we have a hard time, we can't control immediately. We can't change the ozone up there. You know, so it's getting our attention a lot more.
We have some hard choices ahead. And perhaps it's that as much as the consequences of the pollution that scares us a little bit.
I just think about economics, and I think about the fact that the way the airlines work now, they all go to a central point somewhere, to Texas mm-hmm. or Georgia or something. Mm-hmm. So that if you want to fly from the west coast to the east coast, because it's economically feasible, you know, and I know that at Sears and Roebuck, if you buy a tool there and the plug gets broken 10 years later, they won't fix it, but they'll take it in and give you a new tool. Even though it's broken out, it's very small. It seems like all these things just really play into this business of certainly all these things do pollute in order to create them. And so we have something that's immediately in the present. It's economic to do it. And the whole picture is terribly economic to do it. And I just can't believe how that's going to turn around.
One way that we kind of made some cumulative choices that we don't really think about too much would be in our whole pattern of land use, particularly around cities. If you think about suburban sprawl around major cities, we have kind of, as the American dream, a single family home in the suburbs. And yet, what has evolved in this zoning and separation of land uses is that now everybody drives to work in their own car to different places, and you have to drive to shop because there's no store close enough to walk to. So that we've built a whole land use system, a whole pattern of city based on the use of energy in our automobiles and the availability of cheap energy. And yet now we're stuck with that pattern and stuck with the energy use that pattern demands. So there's some fundamental changes in the very structure of our communities.